If you're trying to figure out how to navigate the tricky tightrope of parenting while you have questions, doubts, and wonderings about your spiritual journey, our podcast is for you.
It doesn't matter if your kids are smalls, middles, or bigs. We'll explore what and how we're deconstructing from churchianity, harmful belief systems, and diving deep into the ways we can work this out in parenthood.
We're also going to work through ideas for reconstructing a space for our families to thrive under new systems of love and freedom.
We can't wait to bring you some hope that you're not alone and that it's really okay, even good, to explore all the possibilities that may have felt closed off in the past.
Our podcast is going to offer you grace and space to be exactly where you are and who you are.
We're really glad you're here, and we're excited for today's episode. Listen in.
Violence is antithetical to love. Love looks out for the interest of others, while violence promotes the interests of the perpetrator. Love serves, yet violence dominates. Love is uncontrolling and self-giving. Violence exercises power over and takes what it wants by force. Eric Seibert, Deconstructing Hell.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. We're super excited to have Eric here today. Eric is a PhD, an author, a speaker, a professor of Old Testament. He's got numerous publications, and we're really excited to dive into the Old Testament a little bit today and how that plays out in this idea of hell. So thanks so much, Eric, for being on.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
We're really, really excited to chat with you, but just wanted to ask you quick, what does your day look like? What does your family look like? And then outside of some of those to-dos, what makes your heart come alive?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have three children, so ages 17, almost 15, and 9. So my household is lively and active. This summer, I've been married for 32 years. We waited a bit of time before having our children. I'm a professor at Messiah University, so I do teaching and writing, but a lot of my day is also consumed with just daily domestic duties, making food, washing dishes, transporting children, those kind of things. And it does take a good bit of my time as well. And I'm glad for that. I like to be involved with the family. Part of what makes my heart come alive is talking about issues related to nonviolence, broadly speaking. So we live in a world that's sort of saturated by violence, that sort of assumes that violence is the answer to so many things. And it's always fun for me to help people think about other possibilities, so creative alternatives, whether it's from, you know, what would you do if someone broke into your home, to how do you get rid of a dictator? How can you do those with nonviolence? But I think there's a long history and story of nonviolent struggle and creative actions that we don't tend to hear a lot about. And so it's just really fun to show people there are other ways beyond like doing nothing and killing people.
When you were saying you were married 32 years and the ages of your children, I have been married 32 years and I can't fathom having a 9-year-old. But I was like, wow, he's in the throes of it, really in the thick of parenting kids.
It seems good on the front end of it. Now that we are a bit older, it's like, what were we thinking? My wife is a psychologist. So we both are kind of going through PhD programs and wanted to finish that first so we could be more attentive as parents. So I think that was a good plan. But on this side of it, you do kind of realize that, wow, you know, our friends have kids that are all in college and we're not really there yet. So we'll enjoy the journey.
That's great.
There you go. Enjoy the journey. It's like you can only make decisions based on where you are in the moment, right? We can't look ahead. That's we don't know how it's going to be.
So what's your faith background? If you could sum it up in a phrase or a word. And what is something you believed differently now than maybe 10 years ago?
So my faith background is Christian. I made a profession of faith at a very young age. Church has been a big part of my life. I'm in the church and in various forms of ministry as well. So that's been very important to me. In terms of a belief that is different now, I guess it would have to do with the whole question of God and the problem of evil. So if you'd asked me 10 years ago how I make sense of, you know, evil in the world, I probably would have said something to the effect that, well, you know, God gives people free will and people make bad choices and God doesn't sort of interfere with that free will. And so just God sort of allows certain things to happen, even though that grieves God's heart and God doesn't want that to be. It just is because God doesn't want to take that freedom from us. I've been very influenced by an open and relational theologian named Tom Ord. And so now I would tend to see, it's not that God allows those things to happen, but God cannot unilaterally prevent all evil. And so I would feel very strongly about that. Because again, I think if you say that God could prevent it, but doesn't prevent it, that turns God into some kind of a monster. That's been a pretty big theological shift and has all sorts of implications for, you know, how I think about omnipotence and those kinds of things, which I wouldn't tend to use that word anymore. That's been a big change.
What started the deconstruction journey for you? Was there like a moment or a period in time where you were like, something isn't right here, I need to go
that's
a different direction?
Good question as well. I can't pinpoint like a particular point in time. I think my journey has been sort of a long, slow deconstruction. Like for me, like the earliest memories were when I even began to think about the fact that maybe God doesn't know all the future in exhaustive detail, as I would have thought kind of growing up, and began to, you know, see Bible passages that seem to suggest that God could be surprised and doesn't know everything, and then realize, wow, there's actually like a name for this, open theism. People actually think about this and have written about this. And that was sort of a start. And then I don't think God commands genocide like we read in the book of Joshua. That was sort of another piece of it. And then just some like life experience would be part of it as well. You know, things didn't seem to make sense the way that I'd always been taught they should make sense. I lost my dad to the brain cancer back in 2020. So you kind of begin to see some of those things and you begin to ask questions that, you know, maybe didn't ask quite the same way before. So I think it was just a slow, gradual accumulation of things that began to unravel some of the beliefs I would have had at an earlier age.
Yeah.
It's interesting, Eric, because I feel like, you know, we talk to a lot of people who, when they go way, way back to when they're 5 or 6 professing their faith, like I remember as a kid thinking like, how could God just like drown the Egyptians? Like, why did he take Moses aside? These are also his people. Is there anything like that that you remember as a child? I mean, I know I'm putting you on the spot there with that.
I really don't. Like, I was all in. I mean, it was my whole worldview. Mm. I mean, that's how I made sense of life. I think in that sense, when deconstruction begins, it's hard whenever it happens, but it almost feels like it's harder because I didn't feel like there were those cracks earlier. And so when the cracks begin to come, it's like, wow, you kind of have to rethink so many things if your whole identity and worldview is wrapped up in this way of thinking. But no, I don't remember those questions. I kind of wish I would have had them. Like, I'm sort of jealous when I see like students who have them at university level. And I think, I don't think I was asking the same questions at the point that they're asking that. I feel like they're so much further ahead on the journey. But again, it's a journey. We're all at different points on it. But
yeah, it's always just so interesting to me to hear about people's varying journeys.
I think it makes some kind of sense when we're really little, that black and white thinking, right? Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? And like the Bible stories tend to make some sense as a little person, like, oh, the Egyptians are the bad guys and God was on the good guy's side. And I feel the same way. It's sad to me as I entered into maybe the more normal phase of questioning, like the teenage years, I was shut down with any questions, or I actually shut myself down. And then when I went to college, I did have some professors. I went to a Christian university as well, and they were out of the box thinkers, but my system was so strongly in place that I didn't even give permission for myself to go down that road. And then, like you said, life circumstances happen. That's why I do get a little bit jealous of, say, someone like Liz, who's younger, who is in an environment right now where maybe those questions are allowed to be asked. She grew up in a school system where maybe it was more critical thinking based. My own kids grew up in that. You weren't taught what to think, but more how to think. And so they almost have a big advantage to asking the questions and being allowed to ask the questions. And so I'm with you. And I love the fact for me that God came in and was like, let's put some other crazy things like teenagers in your life. And it's like, okay, let's put some formulas that don't work out. Okay.
Yeah.
So it's interesting for you to say it wasn't anything, where perhaps for other people, it was like, yes, like Liz, like you said, you were 6, 7 years old going, why is God on the Egyptian side?
Yeah. I mean, it never made sense to me. It just didn't. But my father, obviously, you know, he was quite the critical thinker and professor and theologian. And so I think even though I grew up in a more conservative environment, there was a lot of that sort of those kind of conversations. And
well, you recently, we all did, all three of us contributed to a book called Deconstructing Hell. Mm-hmm. And we found your chapter incredibly helpful in our own deconstructing hell journeys. Does the Old Testament, have you found, talk about hell and offer evidence towards its existence?
Yeah, there's really no mention of hell in the Old Testament, and there's no sense of like a two-tiered kind of rewards, punishment, afterlife. The Old Testament talks about Sheol, kind of the shadowy underworld where everybody goes. I mean, that's actually a point of frustration for like the writer of Ecclesiastes, because it doesn't matter how good or bad you are, doesn't matter if you're righteous or you're unrighteous, at the end of it, the writer says the same fate befalls everyone. That's part of the reason why the writer can't seem to make any meaning out of life. So there's just really nothing like that in the Old Testament.
I know the verses that were given to me was like David, when his baby died, said, he will not return to me, but I will go to him. Mm-hmm. And somehow that meant heaven. And then there's Abraham's bosom and Sheol, and people almost make those heaven and hell.
I would just say, like in the David example, people are just reading into the text, because clearly what David is saying is, this child's not going to come back to me, but I'm going to go to the same place the child is, which is Sheol. And same with Jacob and Joseph. When Jacob thought Joseph had been killed, you know, he assumed that, you know, he was going to go meet him in Sheol as well. So it's just that view that they would have had. We sometimes, I think, tend to read our New Testament perception of the afterlife back into some of those texts, but it's really not there.
Right. What does Sheol mean?
So Sheol it's kind of vague. I mean, like geographically, it would be like envisioned as south, like below the flat earth that Israelites envisioned. So it would have been a place down there that, you know, Samuel the prophet kind of comes up from that one point when Saul kind of has him conjured up. But what's going on down there? It's pretty vague, pretty murky.
It's so interesting to me how often we read the Old Testament and the New Testament in a similar way. I think you kind of alluded to that, right? And how different we really need to approach both of them and not kind of like swirl them together. How detrimental is that to some of those Christian belief systems when we're doing that?
Very, I think, because it's like if you read the Bible as a flat book, as though it's all the same, it just creates all sorts of difficulties. I mean, the Bible is like a collection of books. And then beyond that, it's like a whole range of different genres that aren't all meant to be read the same way. And so I think if we look at the Bible as a flat book that it all to be read the same way, we tend to misinterpret, we tend to misappropriate it. We see things that aren't really there because we're just kind of reading into it. So I think we need to be more responsible readers as much as we're able to do that and try to read it with some more texture and nuance.
Right. Do you think that there's a lot of evidence for, say, hell in the idea of eternal conscious torment in the New Testament? I mean, people say all the time, Jesus spoke about hell more than any other thing. Oh, goodness.
Well, I would immediately say, well, that's not true. I mean, what Jesus talked about most was the kingdom of God. God's reign of peace and justice. I mean, that's the grand design. That's what God really wants for humanity. But aside from that, I would say when Jesus is making statements that, you know, where we translated as the word eternal something, Jesus is often speaking there in metaphor and not in literal kinds of language, because talking about like outer darkness on one hand, but then it's like fire on another hand. Well, those two things don't really fit together. So you're having something other than a literal kind of conversation there. But even when Jesus uses that imagery or afterlife discussion, it's always in the service of encouraging people how they should live here and now. Mm. It's not to speculate about what the hereafter may be like. It's simply say, like, what you do now, how you live now, how you treat other people here, it really matters. And so it's in the service of doing that rather than kind of give us some vision or window into the hereafter.
It seems to be almost like the more that people think of heaven as a literal place, in some ways, right? The more they think of hell as a literal place, which is just so interesting to me. It's almost like, okay, well, we have this like palace in the sky, right? So we must have this opposite thing. So interesting to me.
It is. And I think, you know, I think for some people, there's a desire for justice. Mm. There needs to be some righting of wrongs. And so in that way, I think hell serves people's hope that somewhere, somehow, everything will get, you know, set right in the hereafter. I mean, I think that's part of the reason, like within the Old Testament, people envision justice happening more in the here and now. I mean, that was their worldview. So, you know, if you are not obeying God, not living right, God's going to punish you here and now. So you don't really need to have an afterlife because it's settled, the justice sort of takes place. But, you know, as time goes on and people have an accumulation of grievances, they have the hope that somewhere that will be reversed in another space. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you have one, or feels you need to have the other.
Right. Yeah. It's so interesting.
Can we go back to the quote and go into the violence thing a little bit? Violence is antithetical to love. Love looks out for the interest of others, while violence promotes the interests of the perpetrator. Love serves, yet violence dominates. Love is uncontrolling and self-giving. Violence exercises power over and takes what it wants by force. If we look at that quote that was in your chapter, can we dive a little bit deeper into this idea that violence is antithetical to love? Because many of us grew up believing that the two somehow existed together. And that kind of theology can be damaging. And I often think about how damaging the theology of God is love, yet hell is waiting, really harmed so many people, including me. And I think you, Liz, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I mean, I think people often talk about, like, they see God's love and I would say maybe wrath / violent punishment, like as two sides of the same coin, that somehow that like judgment and wrath is like an expression of love and that you can't really be loving toward this person if you're not wrathful toward the one that's doing harm. But I just don't see it that way. For me, God is fundamentally love. So in fact, I wouldn't even just want to say God is loving. Nasty people can be loving, but God is fundamentally love. And again, here I'm sort of channeling Tom Ord, because I would argue that love then is God's primary essential characteristic, that everything you say about God has to be consistent with love. Again, love does not harm. It does not hurt people. Instead, love is like it's serving people. It's coming under people. It's helping people. It's helping them to flourish. And so you can't help one person by harming another, which is, I think, often how we justify violence. Well, okay, yeah, I'm helping this person. And I've got to maybe kill this other person or do this other thing that's maybe not pleasant over here to help this one. But that other person is not going to be experiencing love. If someone's behaving violently toward me, I'm not feeling the love. So the two really do move in different spaces. I think it's important to kind of keep them apart, not kind of somehow try to coalesce them together.
Yeah, it's interesting to me how often we sort of put those two together, you know, this idea of sort of like corporal punishment in order to redirect to a better thing, right? And how somewhere in that, you know, that translation kind of gets lost, because that does not feel loving when you're experiencing that for yourself. And so it can become very, very confusing, I think, often too, about the ways that we talk about this with young children, right? This idea of love linked to this odd sort of abuse in some ways, what that does then for child development, right? And adolescent development later on can be incredibly damaging.
Absolutely. And just as a quick note to that, my wife and I, we decided early on that when we, in our parenting style, we would not spank. Because in my mind, spanking is hitting and hitting is violent. And we didn't want our hands to be associated with acts of violence. So I really do think you want to keep those two things very separate. That my love means guidance, it means correction, it means instruction, but it doesn't mean physical or emotional or psychological or spiritual harm.
Yeah.
Part of the thing, like when I look back at my own journey, and we spanked our kids and so regretfully so, but I believed in a violent God. Mm. And so I keep thinking like those two are so weirdly tied at times. Like if you believe that God is punishing and violent, wiping out the Canaanites, sending people to eternal conscious torment in the cause of justice and holiness, then somehow it's weirdly loving to do violence to your children to get them to be more holy, and you're meeting out justice.
Right.
I guess I just think like how tangled up that idea is, and somehow then love and abuse stand in the same two places.
Yeah, it's just messed up. It's just messed up. I mean, I tell my students sometimes, like if someone's holding the Bible in one hand and they're hitting you with the other, something is very, very wrong here. Like those two don't go together. And in the same way, I do think like our image of God, if we think of God as violent or abusive, controlling, manipulative, that does impact how we parent, whether it's at a conscious level or a subconscious level. You know, we think, well, God sanctions acts of violence in certain situations there, or maybe there's a constructive use for violence and I can use that as well. And this is very toxic and very dangerous.
Well, it's like if it's in the name of, you know, saving someone's eternity, then it's fine to just do that then. Like, you know what I mean? Spank your kids so that they'll be eternally holy, or even just the way that we treat our peers, right? They see things differently than us, and that's a threat. And so the best thing that we can do for them on an eternal level, is to kind of like berate them and sort of like beat them into submission so that they believe what we believe because we need to save them.
All that's going to do is going to cause relational rupture. It's going to make them less likely to trust you. And if that's in any way tied to church or God, it's going to probably make them not want to have anything to do with Christian faith. So it has all sorts of negative kinds of consequences.
Yeah.
What do you say to the people that do say, well, God did tell them to wipe out the Canaanites?
Well, if I was just being direct and blunt, I would say, no, God didn't. Even though the Bible, even though the Bible claims that, I mean, if I was having more time, I would sort of work at that more carefully and say, yes, I realize that the Bible says that, but I don't work with the assumption that God said and did everything the Bible claims. And there's lots of reasons for that to come to a kind of conclusion. So, I think it's very dangerous to simply move directly from what the Bible says about God to then saying that is exactly what God is like.
Right. I watched my own journey with that whole violence in the Old Testament. And I think my first thing was, well, okay, he commanded violence, but like Liz said, for the saving of the Canaanites, it didn't really matter if they were killed in this life because, you know, the afterlife is really what matters. And maybe he was saving them, killing them so that they wouldn't suffer. I mean, all that. And then I went to, which I think I have sort of landed here, and I'm curious about what your thought says. I do believe that all those people, Moses, Josh, believed, just like Hitler or just like in the Crusades, that God was telling them X, Y, and Z. And it's more of like a factual thing, like Joshua thought that God said, go kill all the Canaanites, or he really believed it in his whole heart. But that doesn't actually mean that he was fearing God. And that's sort of where I've landed with how to unpack the Old Testament. And of course, I could shift again. I don't know if you have any kind of more clarity on that.
I guess I would say two things. I mean, I do think the worldview of ancient Israel would be that God was involved in warfare, that God sanctioned natural disasters. I mean, that would have been just the way they would have explained things. You know, if a war is won or lost, is because God was either for them or God was against them. If something terrible happens to their crops, it's because, again, there's divine punishment because of sin. So that's the framework that they would have had. Mm-hmm. That gets reflected in some biblical text. I wouldn't then necessarily say like every biblical story, whether it's, you know, Moses or whether it's Joshua, is like Joshua believing that God said this. Just to use Joshua for example. I mean, that story is thought to be written hundreds of years after the supposed events. People believe it's written during the reign of a king named Josiah, who basically says, hey, look, we're only living on this much of the land, and I'd like to have more. So let's have this story told that says, hey, God promised us this much land, and so we can rally the troops and go get that much land. So that's sort of a different way than saying, yeah, there was a historical Joshua who believed this about God and did these kinds of things. So yes, it's part of their worldview. Yes, it gets reflected in their text, but not every text is historically accurate.
What's textual God versus actual God? And then why is this important when we're studying God's character, especially in the Old Testament, right, where God is really seen as this kind of like standing over you, ready to punish you kind of guy?
So the textual actual God language, I'm actually borrowing from an Old Testament scholar named Terence Fretheim. And textual God is basically like the literary representation of God that we find in the pages of Scripture. Actual God is like living God, creator of the universe, God that we worship. And again, for many people, and again, myself included, for you know, all the way growing up, all the way through college, actually probably even in through seminary, I would have said, you can draw a straight line from textual God to actual God. Like what the text says about God is what God is like. Now I would say you can't do that. It's actually dangerous to do that. You need to figure out what degree of correspondence there is between the two. Because if you simply try to draw a straight line, you end up with a God who commits all sorts of moral atrocities, God who kills indiscriminately women, children, elderly. I mean, it's just a whole lot of folks. And that's, again, for me, morally problematic. I don't see how you can envision a God who does those kinds of things. So I think it matters for how we view God, which matters, I think, then for how we either relate to God or don't relate to God. But I think it also matters, we touched on this earlier, because if you envision God in these kinds of violent ways, it's so much easier to sanction a whole range of acts of violence, whether it's, you know, capital punishment, whether it's warfare, whether it's colonization, whatever it may be. And we have a long, ugly history of that in Christianity, where we see people actually using texts in those kinds of ways. So it really does matter, I think, how we view God.
We'll be right back to the rest of today's podcast episode. But first, we want to give a shout out to some of our amazing and faithful Patreon supporters, Amber Ostrup, Kelsey Longino, and Heather Tilley. For just $3 a month, you can help us keep the lights on and at the same time be a part of our safe and private Facebook community, where you won't feel so alone in this evolving faith and parenting journey. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the episode. When I have asked people about what their thoughts are about violence in the Old Testament and a violent God, say somebody who comes to me, and I think this happens a lot to our listeners all the time, people will say back, God's ways are higher than our ways. So somehow we just can't understand that God is violent and God is love. Can you give us sort of maybe some insight into how we can respond to those people? Not that we ever have to, but I get weary of the God's ways are higher than our ways.
I mean, I think it shuts down conversation because it basically says, don't try to think about it critically. Don't try to explore it. You just have to accept it. And again, I mean, I would be the first to acknowledge there's much about God that I don't understand. I don't have God all figured out by any means. And I'm happy to say there's mystery to God. Mm-hmm. And I would say there are some things that I think God has made very clear, and particularly, you know, through the Christian tradition, like through the person of Jesus, that we can see what God is like. And we do not see through Jesus a God who is violent, a God who is intent on smiting and slaying and slaughtering sinners. This is a God who like pursues them to redeem and restore them. So I just think we know enough about God to say, this is not what God is like.
Right.
I guess, again, if God is this violent being, how can you trust that God will be a good God to you? Like if I was in a dating relationship and sometimes the person is nice, sometimes they're violent. It's like, I don't think that's the kind of person I want to get connected to because I'm not sure which face I'm going to get today or tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then when we bring that to parenting, like the poor kid is, I don't know if I'm going to get violent, spanking mommy or daddy, or I'm going to get merciful mommy or daddy. And I know even in my own parenting, depending on where I was, if I had had enough sleep, if I had had the right things to eat. And so when I look at myself, my kids didn't necessarily know which one they were going to get. And yet I couched it in, I love you no matter what. Right. And so it is interesting how this does play out in our parenting, but even in ourselves, like I still struggle with, is God mad at me? And am I going to get in trouble? And I'm going to get punished? Like he's going to take one of my kids away. He's going to take my husband away. I'm going to have violence perpetrated against me. Or am I going to get this merciful God who's like, oh, I see your pain, Esther, and I see how much you're struggling. You know, I'm going to come alongside and sit with you in that. And so I think we don't think that belief of violence, some people are like, oh, I don't care. It does actually affect almost our everyday, our view of God.
Well, I think that's such a good point too, Esther, because most of us mean well, you know, no one is out there spanking their child because they think it's the wrong thing to do, right? Like they're doing it because they think it's the right thing to do, right? So it's like this theology is like so systemic that we're doing these things because we literally believe that they're right. And we literally believe that they're the best thing for the people that we love. And that's where it becomes so, so damaging because we're all just like so intertwined in this way of relating to others, which I think is mostly what you're saying, Eric. It's this whole like relational mess in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It's sad for me to hear, like you said, that you've got that kind of in the back of your mind, that subroutine that kind of continues to play, like maybe I'm going to get this nasty God, but you're certainly not alone. I mean, I think a lot of people feel that. And I think it's, you know, in the Old Testament, there's a sense of like retribution, right? So like, if I'm disobeying God, I can expect to be, you know, impoverished. I can expect to be, you know, unhealthy. I expect to die prematurely. You know, if I obey God, I expect to be healthy, wealthy, and live for a long time. And that is just deeply ingrained in Israel's psyche. We see it in the New Testament, right? When the disciples are walking with Jesus, they see a guy who's born blind and say, hey, you know, who sinned, right? This guy or his parents? Because if someone's suffering, they have to be because of sinning. And we have this sense that that's how God operates. And God is like a cosmic cop sort of watching over folks to see like when they mess up. So then God can dole out this punishment, because I think it's rooted in the sense that we often are taught that we are sinners. I think that is, again, incredibly unhelpful. think we should say, no, we are human beings created in God's image. We are beloved. We are beloved. And yes, we have broken places, but God is all about like healing and restoring those broken places. God is not sitting up there waiting to punish. And that's such a different way of viewing God than I think we tend to hear, particularly in, you know, American culture and evangelicalism.
Yeah.
How does Jesus play into that, right? Like in the New Testament, right? Jesus comes and you talk in your chapter a little bit about how he sort of deconstructed some of those views of the Old Testament. And there's some real hope there. Can you talk a little bit about how he does that?
Sure. So Jesus is clearly, you know, familiar with Old Testament text, uses them to think about, again, the kinds of things he's teaching. So it's not like Jesus is coming with something brand new, unconnected. But I think Jesus is selective, like in which threads he pulls on from the Old Testament. Sometimes I think it's a direct, I mean, he directly counters theology. Like we were just talking about this theology of retribution. So in like the Sermon on the Mount, which is pretty well known, Jesus says, hey, look, I mean, God sends the sun on the evil and the good, right? Sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. So in other words, God is a God who loves indiscriminately, which is again, really pushing back against some of that thinking. Or even Luke's account of the sermon, Jesus says directly, you know, God is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked. You have at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, he tells these two Old Testament stories about the Sidonian widow and about a Syrian general. So both sort of non-Israelites. And Jesus is sort of making the point, hey, look, God is actually reaching out and caring for these people, even though there are many others in Israel that could be cared for. God is, you know, caring for these outsiders. Mm. So, I mean, when people's view of God begins to get expanded in these kind of radically inclusive ways, that's not always comfortable, but I think it's beautiful because I think that's who God actually is.
My favorite thing that Jesus did was leave out the day of vengeance of our God when he presents himself in the temple and he says, I've come to heal the brokenhearted, set the captive free, give sight to the blind. And then he leaves that one section out. Even just the very beginning of his ministry, he's like, nah, not doing that. It's not about God's vengeance and wrath. And that helps me to always read, say, the Old Testament through the lens of Jesus. Like when I ask people about the violence of the Old Testament and they come back with God's ways are higher than my ways, sometimes I say to them, can you picture Jesus saying, go slaughter all those people? Can you picture Jesus going, kill women and children? And then they just kind of can't respond because no one, I don't care if you're a Christian or not, I don't know anybody that can picture Jesus doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, people in the first century are expecting the Messiah to come and be a conquering king, to use real physical violence to kick out Roman occupiers. Mm-hmm. That is not, that's what Jesus, like, that's not the kind of Messiah I am. Jesus says, I'm not going to overcome violent oppression through more violence. I'm going to overcome it through suffering love. So there is a sense in which Jesus is kind of taking things in a different direction. Again, I think there's threads in the Old Testament Jesus pulls on that helps us to see God in that kind of more loving, merciful, expansive light. Again, it's a tough message for people to hear then, and it still is today. I've always found it interesting when you start to talk about God being nonviolent, people can have a very violent reaction. It's sort of ironic, I always think, when that sort of happens. But people don't like their view of God challenged sometimes.
Yeah. So what do you do like with your kids? So you have three kids, teenagers, tween. I'm sure they hear about hell in like eternal conscious torment. I'm sure they've heard about it. I'm sure they've talked about it with you. What would you say to them if they brought it home? They said, oh my goodness, they probably know what you believe. Do they know what you believe?
Yeah, it's a good question. It doesn't come up much in the church that we attend. So I'm thinking of them like growing up in church. I don't know how much they would have been exposed to any kind of like direct preaching about hell. Like I'm trying to think, I can't remember a sermon that would have been that direct. The emphasis is much more on following Jesus. You know, the tagline that our church uses is, you know, we're leading people to the God who looks like Jesus. And so it's more of that kind of a focus than it is a here's your get out of hell free card type of thing. So I don't know if they would have heard a lot of it through church. I don't think we've had many conversations about it. I'm thinking maybe with one of my kids, we've talked a bit about it. And I think there would have been some surprise that I wouldn't, I mean, if I was to say it bluntly, I would say, I don't believe in hell. I don't believe there's any kind of eternal conscious torment in the afterlife. They would have been surprised that I would have thought that. I think because it's just so much part of our culture that we tend to think of heaven and hell. You know, I think there's different ways you could go about it. Depending on the age of the child, you could simply say, Christians think about this topic in different ways. Here are three or four different views of hell. And you kind of can walk them through all of those. And so they can see that, you know, Christians don't all think alike on that. That in itself is helpful to know that there are other options out there. But again, at the end of the day, for me, a God who is loving is not going to be a God who is torturing people for all time and eternity.
Yeah. So how might the idea of, say, eternal conscious torment, the things that we wrote about in the book, Deconstructing Hell, contribute to a more controlling, violent parenting model versus an uncontrolling, self-giving model? And you alluded to spanking, say, but there's other ways that we can be violent towards children, like shame and fear and guilt. And
yeah, I guess if people are thinking primarily like of hell as people are sinful and God is now needing to punish sinful people, I think sometimes that translates into very simplistic parenting. Child is acting out, therefore child needs to be punished, without like digging a little deeper. And I can't remember who said this, but there's a quote that goes something like, you know, kids who don't feel right don't act right. And so again, if someone's acting out, the question is, well, why are they acting out? Is it that they're having a hard time at school? Is it that maybe they're experiencing bullying on social media? Is it they have some mental health issues that, I mean, need to be addressed? Like, what is going on that's actually creating this kind of behavior? And so I think you want to like dig deeper as a, and if you're viewing the child as beloved, not as this willful person trying to do all these bad things to make your life more difficult. But no, this is a beloved child, and you want to help guide, form, shape them. You want to kind of figure out what's going on. How can we do some things that might, you know, get you living in ways that are more constructive and more helpful, less harmful for you, less harmful for others? I just think that kind of exploration is harder to do if you're simply thinking sin punishment, and that's as far as that goes.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I just think like how much of parenting seems to be getting kids to behave in such a way that makes me actually regulated, not necessarily them actually regulated.
Make my life easier. Just kind of get in line, get with the program, and everything will be so much better. But it's nice if it would work like that, but it doesn't. People are complex. You know, we know that.
Right. And if we have that violent, controlling God, then it is going to naturally play out. If he's our ultimate parent, or she, as I like to say, they are our ultimate parent, then why wouldn't that play out, right? We want to have a controlling, violent model instead of this self-giving, which is exhausting. Yeah. I think how much more difficult parenting is when you're doing the uncontrolling, self-giving model. And have you found it more difficult? Or were you raised like this as well? That was modeled for you, so it kind of plays out for you?
I mean, just to come back to spanking for a moment, like I was only spanked once. It's a story I tell. Like, it was when I allegedly stole a Pez candy dispenser, you know, which I have this memory of like having it at home, but not like, I don't remember like thinking I'm going to steal this thing from the store and bring it home. But once I had it at home, I'd had no interest in taking it back to the store. So no, spanking was not a big part. Like any kind of that discipline was not a big part of my upbringing. I guess I just don't find, I think you're right. It's more complicated to parent in ways that are not violent, because violence is easy, very easy. It's very easy just to smack or to hit or to yell. That doesn't take much. It's a lot harder to control those, you know, impulses. So while I've never, you know, physically abused my children, there are moments when they test my commitment to nonviolence, right? I think it takes a lot more creativity. And I think it's been said that, you know, violence is really a lack of imagination. And I think I heard you saying that, Esther, earlier, like when you're tired, when all these things, like you just kind of at the end of your rope, you just, violence is sort of the natural next step. And so we have more imagination, more capacity. There are so many other ways to shape our children that don't involve that kind of physical or emotional harm.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, I think about, you know, my kids, the way that I'm raising them and how hard it is. And I mean, I yell at times and obviously not perfect, but raising them in this more sort of like gentle, intentional parenting way that you're talking about, and how hard it is when they just have a meltdown in the middle of Walmart, right?
Yep.
And the options are you kind of like put the fear of God in them, right? And you like get them, you get them off the floor so that nobody thinks you're a bad parent, right? Right. Or you sit with them in this huge emotional reaction that they're having and you're embarrassed as anything, right? Yep. So kind of what Esther said, it comes a little bit more about like you as a parent and kind of putting your own stuff aside to look at this little being as beloved and as going through something and say, all right, if we need to just kind of like cry on the floor of Walmart for a little bit, people can walk around us, but that's really hard.
It is hard.
It's really, really hard.
Yeah. Social shame or our perception of social shame. And I think too, like before we're parents, like we see that as like, I will never do that as a like, here it is, like here it's happening. Like, what do I do in that moment? But you know, the thing is, in those moments, if we respond violently, then we have two messes to clean up. The mess that was already there, but now we have this relational mess. It just makes things worse. Sometimes gentle, loving forcefulness is okay to move a child from point A to point B, but that has to be done really, really carefully. And as children get bigger, that no longer works.
The football carry out of Walmart, you know, where your kid's under your arm and you're like, all right, we just got to get out of here.
The thing that is the most encouraging to me, hearing that even you, and you're probably closer to my age, were not dealt with violently as a child. Somehow I think for those of us who are deconstructed or the young parents, they're like, oh no, if I don't spank or if I don't do this, my kids are going to just run amok and be horrible people. And I think, what a testimony. That is not actually what happens. And so those of you guys who are listening right now, there are so many testimonies out there of no, one does not automatically mean the other. We can do all of this without any violence, and kids are going to be okay. Mm-hmm. They may actually grow up more healthy and more loved and, you know, less filled with shame and fear.
And maybe just a point to tack onto that too. I think we talk a lot about like, if we envision God a certain way, that can influence our parenting. But in the same way, the way we parent will influence how our children perceive of God. And so if we really want our children to be connected to faith in healthy ways, then our parenting needs to model, again, nonviolent, constructive, creative kinds of, you know, discipline, guidance, instruction, and so on. Or they will have warped views of who God actually is.
Right.
Ooh. Yeah. That's powerful.
But if you could preach one message to a stadium filled with people who are venturing forward on their faith journeys that perhaps may look differently from the way they grew up, what would you say?
Say, good for you. I'm right there with them. I say, I deeply respect your courage. I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage and bravery to kind of move beyond some of the ways that we have been formed in our faith communities, because that's sort of our, you know, it's our tribe, it's our group, it's how where we find identity, acceptance, validation. And so to move beyond that is not easy. I'd encourage them to, you know, go ahead, color outside the lines. Don't be inhibited by people who are going to keep pulling you back and say, no, you have to think in these kinds of ways, and these other kinds of ways are, you know, not acceptable. At some point, I probably would quote Kathy Escobar, who's written this fantastic book called Faith Shift. She says that when she talks to people whose faith is sort of, you know, unraveling or they're moving in different directions, she says, you're not crazy and you're not alone. I think those two things are really helpful, because if you really do kind of go on a serious deconstruction journey, it is not easy. It's hard. You begin to wonder, there's doubts. Am I really off the rails here? Does anybody else think the way I do? And I would say, you're not off the rails. And there are many other people who think the way you do. It's a journey. You're on a journey. You're at this point in the journey. Try to find some other pilgrims that are on the journey, maybe somewhere similar to where you are, and travel with them. So you don't need to kind of go it alone.
I have a faith crisis almost every single day. Like, my husband came in the door last night. He goes to work a couple days a week, and he came in and I was like, I just was wondering, like, is this all like a ruse? Do I even believe in Jesus? I mean, and we sat at dinner and I said, oh my goodness. And here was my big question. Why is God so mysterious? That's kind of mean. Like, can't he just be up there saying, this is who I am, this is how it is? And I have those thoughts every single day. And I would imagine hopefully others out there, even we continue to have them. And I don't think they're going away anytime soon.
But it sounds like you're still in the game. Like, you're still wrestling. You're still asking questions. You're still thinking about it, you know, and there's different days you'll have different feelings and that's up. I think that's part of the natural journey of faith. Again, I think it's when we kind of get our faith all tightly knit up in a box and we think we've got it. That's where real trouble begins.
Yeah.
And I guess I would also say, I mean, people on faith journeys, like, again, I would encourage people to explore that wherever that takes you. just so long as it's not taking you in places that are harmful to you or to others. Like that would be my one boundary marker where I say, if that's happening, then you need to kind of do a course correction and come back and explore it through different kind of avenues.
That's good. Let's take it back from the crowd of 50,000 down to your kitchen table with your three kids. Okay, but pretend it's tonight and you're sitting with them at dinner. And if you knew they would listen to you, which is a caveat, since you have tweens and teens, and they would soak a particular truth into their soul and then take it with them on their life's journey. And I'm sure you've thought about this. Like, what do I really want my kids to take away from me? What legacy do I want to leave with my kids about, say, God, faith, and themselves? What would you say?
Yeah, I love this question. I mean, it makes me think of like the, you know, if you found a genie in a bottle and you got three wishes, what would those be? Well, my first wish would be that I get an infinite number of wishes, right? So I kind of keep going. So like, if I were to give them one truth, it'd be like, all the parental wisdom I've given you over all these years, it's all true, like embrace it. But if I can't do that, I guess I would want to say to them something like, you are enough. And I found this beautiful card that I gave my wife at one point, probably on anniversary or something. But the phrase was, I will never finish loving you. Not I will never stop loving you, because that feels like it could end. But I will never finish loving you. There's always more of you to love. And it doesn't matter what you accomplish, what you don't accomplish. Doesn't matter how important or unimportant you feel in the world's eyes. Like, I will never finish loving you. So that they have this secure base, you know, secure attachment. That from that security, they can go out and make their way through the world. I will celebrate their successes. I will support them in their challenges. If they just know that I'm there, I'm rooting for them. If they could really hear that, I think that would serve them well.
I love that.
Well, thank you so much. I have to say this has been really, really challenging even for me and helpful for me. And I think for our listeners. And if we always ask this one question right at the end, so what's something that you've maybe had to show your past self grace for? And then what's something maybe in the future that you'd like to give yourself space for?
So for my past self, when I started teaching, I can recall in a classroom making some kind of comment about the creation story. I think I was talking about like God's acts of creation. I talked about human sexuality in a way that was very, the only way that God is pleased if we're talking about one man and one woman in marriage. And, you know, I made that trope, God created Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And I just think back to that moment. I wonder who was sitting in that classroom. What sorts of students were there? Were there some who identified as LGBTQ? What kind of harm did that do? And so I just deeply regret that. Even beyond a specific statement like that, there have been other things that people would have picked up on where they would have known in my mind, I'm thinking that the only right kind of marriage is between a man and a woman. I'm now fully LGBTQ affirming. I feel it's really, really important. I think it's consistent with Jesus's radical inclusivity. And so I kind of have to say, yes, that was then. I'm at a different place now. But it's hard when you've said things like that in public and you don't quite know what the impact may have been. I think going forward, I talk a lot about love, believe that God is love. I believe, you know, I do agree with Jesus, like greatest commandments to love God, to love your neighbor. I just really want to develop a greater capacity to love. There is still prejudice, implicit bias, all sorts of other things in me, if I'm honest, that I don't like and wish weren't there. So I want to keep working at having an ever expansive way to love and accept others.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much for, you know, sharing your wisdom and vulnerability with us. This has been so wonderful, so eye-opening. So helpful as we're all kind of navigating our faith journey, and then specifically this idea of hell and God as a violent God. So thank you so much.
Yes.
Thanks. It's been great talking with you.
I'm taking away that little quote you had today, and I think this can go for everybody in our lives. If they don't feel right, they're not going to do right. And I think that for me, that's the grace that we can have for ourselves and as we are with each other and our kids. Oh, that's fabulous. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. We love that you tuned in and hope that this gave you a little bit of grace and space for your soul to breathe.
Don't forget to catch up on any of our episodes that you missed. And remember to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Deconstructing Mamas.
That's where you'll find all the information that you need about the podcast, as well as on our website, deconstructingmamas.com. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter when you get there.
If you'd like to support the podcast, join our Patreon network for just $3 a month and have access to our private community with all kinds of extras Leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, or just tell others about the show.
Thanks for listening, and come back again for our next episode. We can't wait to be on the other side of your headphones.